This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Since its inception in the summer of 1949, the Air Force Medical Service has sought to provide service members and their families with first-rate health care and benefits anywhere and at any time. In support of deployed forces, the AFMS also plays a central role in the most effective joint casualty care and management system in military history, a system that has saved thousands of lives that otherwise would have been lost on the battlefield. With us this morning to discuss his leadership in this area is our very special guest, Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. General, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Brenda Dixon. Brenda, welcome.
Thank you.
General, our listeners are very familiar with the U.S. Air Force. They may not be as familiar with the U.S. Air Force Medical Service. Could you outline the mission and history of AFMS? How has its mission evolved over the years to support DOD's overall mission?
Well, the Air Force Medical Service was established about 2 years after the Air Force was formed, July of 1949. In fact, we continue with pretty much the same mission as we started with, to support air, and at that time, it was in its infancy, but space operations. We lost a lot of the space operations in 1958 when the NASA actually stood up. But the reality of our mission has always been for the Air Force to fly, fight, and win, and for the Air Force Medical Service to enable them to do that by creating health within our military force and also to try and restore health whenever someone was injured in any way. And so as you look at what our various missions have been, setting up hospitals and deploying our medics to somewhere far away, what's happened over the years is we've also picked up an air evacuation mission, which is a little broader than the Air Force because we also use air evacuation to bring back casualties from all the services. And so I'd say that right now the Air Force Medical Service critical mission in terms of what this country relies upon us for is for the air evacuation. But the reality is there's a whole lot of links that go in there, and we're still pretty much focused on winning in air and space. And the newest mission over the last 10 years is winning in cyberspace.
General, with such a broad mission and an important mission, would you provide us with a sense of scale of operation? How is your office organized? What's the size of its budget? And how are your personnel deployed across the world?
I have immediately working for me about 42,000 active duty and civilians, another 8,000 reservists, and approximately 6,000 guardsmen that are functioning in the medical missions. To support all of those folks, I have a budget of about $2.6 billion in defense health program funds and another $2.5 billion in personnel accounts. We use those dollars not only for the readiness mission, but also to provide health care for about 2.2 million beneficiaries that are Air Force beneficiaries. The total for the Defense Department is 9.5 million beneficiaries. I have about 1.1 million of those beneficiaries actually enrolled to care within my system.
What about your official responsibilities as the Surgeon General of the Air Force? Could you give us a sense of what they are and what's a week in the life of a Surgeon General?
Well, my daughter, when she was six, kind of summed my life pretty well. She said when asked what her dad did, I thought she'd talk about being a general, or I thought that she'd talk about being a doctor, and I was waiting for the impressive answer. And the impressive answer was, my dad goes to meetings and answers phone calls and does email. The reality is I work in a policy world, and so working with others to develop policy and find new ways to do things is pretty much what I do most of the time.
That sounds actually very interesting. In that role, what would you say are the most important challenges that you're facing today?
Well, obviously, we always try to keep up in terms of maintaining the cutting edge in terms of our deployed medicine, our readiness mission. The secondary thing I would tell you is, in order to do that, I have the responsibility for training and equipping those medics so that they're ready to do that. And that involves trying to maintain state-of-the-art medicine back here at home. And no less than those two is the third mission, which is really to ensure a healthy force. And to do that, I have to basically leverage the very best in primary care to try and make certain that we are helping our beneficiaries stay healthy so that hopefully they don't need our assistance when they go overseas. Those are the challenges, and those have been the challenges probably from the beginning. And there's just some unique ways we're trying to do that now.
I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about you personally. I suspect that when you joined the Air Force or became a doctor, you weren't thinking, you know, you're embarking on a life of meetings and email. You were thinking about becoming both a physician and an officer. What attracted you to that kind of a dual life, if you will?
Well, I was young when I came into the Air Force. In fact, it took a waiver for me to get a commission because I was only 18 when I actually took the oath. The reality is that I'd finished high school a little early. I finished college actually a lot early, got my degree in chemistry in 2 years. So I was 18 years old, had been accepted to professional school. I was thrilled. That's what my dream had been. And my father pointed out that because I'd done it so fast that my other brothers were right behind me to go to college, and I probably should consider taking a scholarship with the military. I wasn't too excited about that, I'll be honest. But his words were prophetic. He said that he thought that I would do well with a little structure in my life. And here I am some 36 years later, still kind of applying that structure that I've learned so well. I chose family practice because I really liked the challenge of what was going on. I went to school in Milwaukee. Basically, when I came in the Air Force and finished my family practice, I thought I'd do my commitment and get out in 4 years. I was a very young physician. I came in at around 22 out of medical school, finished the residency, and did 4 years out delivering babies, delivered 400 or 500 babies in various states. And then kind of got involved because I was doing well clinically. They asked me if I would supervise other physicians, and I became a chief of hospital services and ultimately became a commander of hospitals. And the rest, I guess, is history as I've gone through various periods in my life, I guess. I went through 4 different hospitals that I commanded, the largest of which was Wilford Hall. Somewhere in there, I also was the command surgeon for various major commands, probably the most interesting of which was out in the central command area where I was basically the CENTCOM surgeon and got to travel with the 4-star and meet the heads of multiple countries as well as the ministers of health, etc. And the most exciting time I've had in the military was my time in the Philippines where I kind of finishing some work at Harvard in public health, I went out to the Philippines and suddenly became an expert in disaster operations after the Baguio earthquake and the Mount Pinatubo volcanic eruption. I found myself doing some amputations under buildings, doing a lot of public health. I suspect that my career in the Air Force was sealed at the time I did that work because it was too exciting to walk away from, but I have done a lot of different jobs in the Air Force. If you ask me what the most valuable thing I've done in the Air Force, it's probably the current airbag system. I was at Air Mobility Command at the outset of 9/11 and saw some things to come together and took where we were and built a system that's getting our casualties back in 3 days. We found ways to leverage equipment and critical care personnel to bring people back safely much more rapidly than what they'd done in the past. And I think when all is done and I finish my career, I will look back and say, although I had fun in the Philippines with disaster operations, I probably really made a difference when it came to moving casualties back to the States.
General, as you reflect on your training and career, both as a physician and an officer, what are the characteristics of an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected and networked world?
From my perspective, I think you have to be very attuned to the people. I think that you have to know kind of where they're coming from. When you're looking for innovation in particular, you have to bring teams of very talented individuals together and listen to what they say, hopefully leveraging their experience to find new ways of doing things. I find that when you bring people together in an environment where they feel safe and can talk about those things that are a little different or they wish was different, that we can make kind of remarkable things happen. More often than not, I find that I create a common vision for folks. I get them to come in and share their ideas, and then I leverage the information that they share so that we can create something new. And it's worked for me with small hospitals and modular capability. It's worked for me in disaster operations. I will say that in disaster operations, I'm much more directive. But the reality in terms of trying to find new solutions is to get people to feel safe, to build trust, and then have everyone take pride in the final solution set that you're able to put out.
But what about the success of the Air Force's aeromedical evacuation capability? We will ask Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Also joining us today from IBM is Brenda Dixon. General, you've outlined the Air Force Medical Services vision for 2010 and beyond as, quote, trusted care anywhere. Would you elaborate on your strategic vision as encapsulated in that statement? And what are the practical implications of pursuing such a vision?
You know, I read several books over the years regarding how to manage and how to lead people. And one of the things in today's environment that folks seem to be tired of are lengthy strategic plans and business plans. And so I looked for a mantra, and trusted care anywhere was what I thought really fit what we do. In large part, the challenges to achieve trusted care anywhere are to create a system that can be taken anywhere in the world and be just as useful, whether it's in war or in humanitarian assistance, and can create links back to the American standard of care, wherever that may be. And honestly, that's something that we can teach others to show better ways to interface. It takes a huge amount of training. It takes a lot of creative people putting together those systems that will actually work when you get them into an austere environment. And it takes us trying to teach others how best to request our assistance and when, because it takes some time to set up a hospital in an austere environment. It takes a little bit of time to create those logistic routes and get things in place. And I say a little bit of time. My newest challenge to our folks is in our modular expeditionary medical capabilities to be able to see the first patient in an hour of the time they arrive and to do the first surgery within 3 hours. Today, it takes us 12 to 24 hours to accomplish those things in setting up a hospital in a deployed setting. On the AirVac side, when you're bringing people home and having them back in the States in 3 days, it's a little tough to beat that. But we're finding there are certain classes of patients that we need to be cautious with to make sure we don't move them too early, that we make sure their staging stops are where they can get the right care so that we never cause any harm, and that honestly, for other patients, if there's a way to get them home to their families quicker by using things like polar routes and different types of transportation, we're trying to leverage that as well.
Could you tell us, you know, especially around the AirEvac and this expeditionary medical support that you were just talking about, how has that changed over the last decade through the last couple of wars that we've been involved with?
If we were talking just after Desert Storm, so 1991 timeframe, we would have been talking about 50-bed air transportable hospitals. We would have been talking about the likely 13 or 14 C-141s at the time that it took to transport it there. And today, really 19 years later, we are working with expeditionary medical systems that I can set up an initial hospital in 4 pallet positions and basically take all of my team, have everything in place on a single aircraft, and that's just the expeditionary medical side. On the AirVac side, we've created teams that, because we're now not going to hold patients in theater, we're going to bring them home faster, we had to create teams that were able to take care of critical patients, similar to what you would see with a neonatal transport team here in the States. Basically leveraging a 3-person team, taking care of 3 to 5 very critically ill patients, And we move them across continents, and we do it in hours. We stage them into Europe at Landstuhl. We do a secondary staging surgery, and within another 12 hours, they'll be back here in the States.
So back over in Iraq and Afghanistan, what are the challenges that you face in the installations there in Balad and Bagram, as well as other locations around the world?
Well, now that we've been in the war for 9 years, we've moved into fixed facilities, and so we have a lot more American standard assets. We have state-of-the-art CT. We have state-of-the-art endoscopy. Really, pretty much any equipment you'd see in a normal hospital back here in the States is what we have now over in the theater. We're seeing that as Iraq has become quieter, that we are seeing days where our hospital in Balad is now empty, which is exactly what we're hoping for. And we're trying to pick up on the training mission to make sure that the Iraqis have the graduate medical education and skill sets to manage that equipment for themselves. In Afghanistan, it's a little different. In Afghanistan, it's still pretty much a war zone. We're seeing far too many casualties still coming through there. We'd love to see that decrease. But we've also moved to fixed facilities over the 9 years. We have our people working in these fixed facilities and some tented facilities in remote areas where basically we're doing the stabilization surgery and starting the process for the care as they come back home. The challenges in Iraq are different than they are in Afghanistan. Iraq has a very developed medical system over the years, has trained physicians and nurses for other Middle Eastern countries. And Afghanistan, based on their prolonged time at war, has seen an exodus of many of their medical professionals. And so we really, I think, are somewhat challenged to try and see expertise brought back into country so that we could transition back to the Afghanis.
So as you think more about continuing to enhance and transform these capabilities, expeditions, and AeroEvac, what are your thoughts? What are your lessons learned? Where do you see that going?
Well, we're really pushing to see if we can't, in austere situations, basically set up our tentage and be ready to see casualties even more rapidly. If you ask why that is, I would tell you that although we're working in fixed facilities in our larger areas of conflict, in the last year, I've deployed forces into Indonesia, also into Haiti, and as well into Chile for humanitarian relief following earthquakes. And essentially what we find is that by the time help is able to be requested, we're getting in there somewhere within the 24 to 72-hour time frame, and they need our help immediately. And so if I can get my expeditionary assets to do that even more quickly, I can be even more useful in all of the other types of activities that we get called to assist. Even back here in the States, we now work with FEMA and the DMAT teams and the MCERT teams trying to set up assets that parallel the assets they've set up, but also to try and help them understand how to link with our AeroVac system. In the case of the DMAT teams, there's now a new what they call DASIF, Disaster Aeromedical Staging Facility, and in essence, they're going to be set up so that they're civilian equivalents to our mobile aeromedical staging facilities and can use commercial airlift to try and move patients out of the way of a hurricane. The idea is always to do this in a preventive way. In order to do that, you have to move quickly because they make the call always late.
Well, General, I wonder if you could help us understand a little bit about how information technology and the advances in information technology has enhanced your efforts in the field. And specifically, could you tell us more about your investment in innovative informatics and how it ensures a higher delivery of care?
None of the things I've talked about are possible without informatics. Without an electronic health record of some sort, you'd have no continuity from site to site. And so I would tell you that the most critical infrastructure that was created was a product called TRACES. TRACES is a system that tracks patients similar to the way Federal Express would track packages. We had to know where people were in the system and what had been done to them. We needed to know specifically what had happened, not just when they got from port to port, if you will, but also what was happening to them on board the airplanes. And so our new systems, an expansion really of the Theater Medical Information Program, Air Force, has now got an electronic record that even collects information in the air. There's been integration of products in terms of the joint patient tracking system into our theater medical information program so that we can now look on a computer, web-based, and know exactly where a casualty who was injured yesterday is in the system, what's been done to them, what the physician's notes are. And if you don't have that capability to see what's going on as they transit the system, you can't have the supplies and the personnel ready for what needs to happen at the next stage. And so I would tell you that without the informatics, we couldn't be where we are. And back here at home, it's really the same. The electronic health record allows us to move people to any of the military hospitals where these folks may be stationed and where their care can be continuous without any break or without any problems with patient safety, so that you know exactly what's been done.
So I'd like to continue along those lines about a seamless electronic patient record. How are you working with the Department of Veterans Affairs to ensure a seamless information flows between the services and VA?
I think that the integration of VA and DOD is probably one of the greatest frustrations for all of the services. When you look at the VA's system, which is called VISTA, it's a wonderful system designed pretty much with the provider in mind, and it's easy to collect information. And when you go to the Washington VA and talk with the folks there, they absolutely love working with it and see the utility immediately. If you go to an Air Force hospital and talk with one of our providers regarding ALTA, you'll find those who like it and those who don't. The problem with ALTA, which is the system we designed, is that it was designed for computable information and for sharing information across wide areas. Both are useful, okay? Both are necessary. We'd like to copy the VISTA system for provider interface, and we'd like to have the VISTA system have our computable data in the back end. How to get there has been quite the technology challenge. And so today, there's a lot of sharing of information between databases, but the inputs remain different, and there's huge investment in the billion-dollar range over the next few years to create a much better integrated system with better sharing of information. Today, a VA hospital can tap into the web-based systems and actually into their own VISTA and get information from the theater regarding what's happening with the casualty in transit. The place this is most useful is in the polytrauma centers that deal with our traumatic brain injuries. But is the information in the same format that they're used to? No. Is the information in our system that comes from the VA in the same format that we're used to? No. Do we need to correct this? Yes, we do, and it's coming. The interesting piece that I think, and this is probably far into the future, but when you look at a lot of the new voice recognition software and some of the things that now interpret voice, I'm wondering whether we're going to need the computable data or if you're going to see that the electronic health record takes a twist and goes to where you now use the technologies that basically take voice and pull from that voice the computable data and create new ways of looking at it. Because from a physician standpoint, if I can simply dictate my standard note and not have to worry exactly what system I'm putting it into, and then some computer machine, okay, basically takes my note, looks at it, stratifies it, puts it into context, and pulls out those computable elements that everyone else needs to know from my note, that's the best of all worlds. And I think we're going in that direction.
General, I'd like to transition a little bit to your ever-expanding humanitarian mission. Would you elaborate on some of the involvement in global humanitarian efforts? And moreover, what efforts are underway to incorporate the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief response capability into all of your expeditionary medical systems and assets?
In terms of incorporation, as part of the renewal of our expeditionary medical capabilities, we're trying to place modules in so that we would have the right equipment regardless of what we responded to. The modules could be pulled and pushed into the packages as easy as taking a few boxes in and out of our pallet positions. The types of things we planned for, we found out with Katrina we weren't well prepared for geriatric response. We found in South America that we weren't very well prepared for OB and pediatric response. And so if you think about it, okay, it's just a different population depending on the mission when you go into a humanitarian response. And with just the few hours notification, we now have modules that are set up for pediatrics or OB or geriatrics so they can simply be inserted without changing necessarily the weight or cube for the planning purposes. That's the way we're incorporating response capability. But it's probably much more complex than that because you also don't want to sweep in and take over. What you want is to augment the systems that are in place, particularly on a humanitarian response. The goal here is not to try and replace infrastructure that may be struggling, perhaps in the first 24 hours until they can mobilize or get their families through the initial trauma of whatever the event is. But after that, these people have jobs. These folks want to come back. They want to basically take care of their own. And so you want to interface with the local governments. And so much of what we're doing now is to try and to create international health specialists, people who are familiar with culture and understand the planning that goes on in other countries where we may respond. We've been working towards trying to build capabilities not only in this country but in others. The best example in the last year was Chile. In Chile, we had a good idea of what we were stepping to. We took our expeditionary medical capability, placed some of the modules in for obstetrics and pediatrics based on the population we were going to be serving, took it out there, and because of some work that had been done with the Chilean Air Force, they were ready to accept our expeditionary medical assets. They basically took our equipment, worked with us for about 3 weeks. The country purchased that equipment, added some tents of their own, converted our 25-bed hospital into a 100-bed hospital, and they're operating that today. And we were out in about 3 weeks. This is the kind of activity that we think we offer when any nation really needs help. But it takes some pre-work, and in order to do that, there's a lot of controversy, I'd say, in the U.S. government regarding how much should be military, how much should be State Department, and how do we interface the two so that they're augmenting one another for response when we run into a humanitarian situation.
How's the Air Force Medical Service embracing disruptive innovation? We will ask Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild, examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Also joining us today from IBM is Brenda Dixon.
So, General Green, you and I have talked in the past about the concept of disruptive innovation. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you think that might apply to the Air Force Medical Service and what your vision is for how the medical service can be disrupted?
It is a tough thing in a bureaucracy to kind of create that disruptive innovation. What I try and do is bring people up from basically out in the hinterlands, okay, who are doing the job, and have them tell me the things that aren't working very well. And we get them to tell us how it could be done better. One of the things, it was kind of a misstep on my part when I first became the deputy surgeon, was to try and solve some issues in terms of our primary care by creating a rotational model that would try and create stability. I learned rather quickly, talking with the people out in the field, that there wasn't enough manpower for them to do the job as we wanted them to. After sitting down with seven different representatives from seven facilities, we came up with a concept that we called the Family Health Initiative. And the Family Health Initiative was a way to try and improve Air Force primary care practice by essentially changing it from primary care, where you were seeing any patient who called to get an appointment, to something that was more team-based and patient-centered by allowing the patient continuity with a provider. We had worked towards this over a number of years and hadn't achieved it. And we put out a new model that we, as we said, called the Family Health Initiative. And as we looked at it, it turned out that it was so similar to what the American Academy of Family Practice was calling patient-centered medical home, that we essentially said that our Family Health Initiative would be a transition to patient-centered medical home. Now, we have set up patient-centered medical home at 13 facilities in 2009, and this year we've added another 10. Next year, I hope to have all of our facilities across the Air Force in the patient-centered medical home concept. By the end of September, I'll have 330,000 patients that now have a single provider and a team of professionals that are responsible for their care. By the end of 2012, I'll have 1 million beneficiaries that will have that type of access. Now, why is that disruptive? Well, remember, I live in a system where my providers typically move every 3 years and where my patients move every 3 years. And so to try and create continuity in a system that's moving like that, not even including the deployments, is kind of unheard of. And yet our initial results at the first bases where we stood this up 2 years ago, they've gone from having about 30% of the time that you saw the same physician to about 70% of the time you see the same physician. And 95% of the time you're seeing the physician or his partner who's an extender, whether nurse practitioner or PA. And that's what we want. And if you do change assignments and go somewhere else, you'll get a new doctor and a new physician extender. But the reality is you'll know that there's the same team that's there to watch after you, and it creates that trust that I'm seeking.
So besides continuity of care, can you tell us a little bit more about what is important for the patient-centered medical home concepts that is driving improved quality of service?
Well, I started off early in the interview talking about my desire to try and make certain that people were as healthy as they possibly could be before they would deploy. Not just our medical people, but all of our beneficiaries. Because it's not so much that I want to do work in health. I'd rather that everybody was healthy and I was just on standby mode. And so one of the things that I've put in motion is something that I called patient-centered precision care. And precision care has to do with trying to tie genetic information so that we can actually reach out directly to a patient that's now in these medical homes and offer them a level of prevention and a futuristic plan for how we will take new information to improve their prevention over the next 50 years. I'm going to bring informatics to bear so that when we see evidence that's associated with genetic information, we're going to start basically applying that out to the patient directly. So to get there, there are several steps. I had to have people in these medical homes. I have to have secure patient messaging, the ability to reach out and tell these patients something that's new or something that may affect their health. And I have to have the ability to manage huge volumes of data. And so if you think about it, we're doing a lot of genetic testing today based on different medications or lab tests or cancer interventions. I want to partner with a host of organizations that are collecting this information. I want to put it in a repository. I want to protect it. And as part of a study, I want to basically look at associations. And today, where you'll see an association with maybe 3 or 4 base pairs, tomorrow I think you may see an association of a disease with someone who has a common 10,000 base pairs. I now will know who has those 10,000 base pairs, and I'll reach out to them wherever they're assigned in one of my medical homes and say, a new finding has suggested that you may benefit from this discussion. Now, there's another piece. I have to have clinical decision support so that physicians who are out there are also ready to take this information and apply it to their physician. And so we have programs that are being developed today that can take today's known evidence-based medicine and apply it to a patient. Think about it. An FDA warning comes out with a black box warning, which is what they send to pharmacies to let them know there's some medication that has a new risk. Today, that goes out to the pharmacies. The pharmacies basically look through their books, and the patient may find out about it in days, weeks, sometimes months. And what I'd like to have is that all happens in seconds to minutes. And so if we can get the information to the patient that rapidly and get that information to the doctor, then instead of things taking 14 to 17 years today in terms of how innovations reach new clinical practice, I want to get it down to where it doesn't take years, but to where it takes minutes for things to get into a physician's hands to deal with a patient who may have a problem they never even thought about.
General, how does the patient-centered medical home model represent a fundamental shift in the patient-doctor relationship, and how does it facilitate the military health system's quadruple aim?
Well, the quadruple aim starts with readiness, of course, and we've talked a lot about that. But then the second piece of that is better health. The third piece is better care, and finally, best value. The better health is where the big bang for the buck is here, because the goal is, if I can take it to the level I'm talking about, then in the medical home, where they now know this patient better than anyone, I can have what I'm calling an applied clinical epidemiology cell, pass information to the physician that the patient may have no signs or symptoms and not even realize that they're at risk. But because I know where the patient's assigned, I know how to reach out and touch those folks because of these databases that are actually feeding information to the physicians. That allows me to make sure that their health is the very best. It also allows me to improve the care of the physician because that physician now has decision support that he wouldn't have known that this was something even to consider on this patient. I'll use an example. There's information today. It's not yet evidence to where we can apply it. But there's evidence today that one of the associations genetically is between presenile dementia and cholesterol levels. If your LDL is too high and you have a certain genetic structure, you may well be prone to presenile dementia. When I talk with multiple audiences and tell someone who's in their 30s that if I could basically put them on a statin drug and try and decrease their LDL at a much earlier age, and that would delay presenile dementia by 10 or 15 years, how many people do you think would start that medication? And so it's these kinds of things I think we need to be looking at because we can learn and basically set up multiple Framingham studies to basically study what we know about genetics to apply information about common genetics at a much earlier age and see if we can't promote longevity and much better health.
So switching gears a little bit, tell us a little bit more about how you are working to look at groups of patients. So you have stood up you're working with the MHS Population Health Portal. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We have had some experience with aggregating data. And so today, in what we call our Population Health Portal, we have nearly 80 terabytes of information. This is not the electronic health record, but it does extract certain elements of data from the electronic health record. It also then links that with billing data and all of the ICD-9 codes, which tells us about people's diseases. And it links it with their pharmaceutical data, as well as the DEER system, which tells us about our beneficiaries. When you take all of those databases together, you end up with huge amounts of data that has to be filtered to become information. To try and create that information, we've taken a group of people that are tied to our multiple consultants in various specialties and built what we call an applied clinical epidemiology cell. These folks filter the best evidence-based medicine, and through a program now that's called CarePoint, where we basically will do the physician decision support, we allow folks to see this data, which has now been taken and created into information packets, so that they can look at their assigned population and see where they should focus their efforts to best improve health. That's also where I want to put the genetic information when it comes out and leverage this new program called CarePoint. Because I do believe that when you're dealing with these huge volumes of information, when you're talking 80 terabytes of data, you've got to have something that breaks it into manageable chunks and gets it so that you can define and target specific areas where you want to make a difference. And that's why we're working with industry leaders in terms of ways to make information from data, not just on an experimental basis, but also to take what's known today and then apply that to the databases, pull that out, and apply it today.
You mentioned in working on this genetic initiative, you mentioned working with various partners that you're doing that and you'd like to continue to do that. Is there research, medical research, that the Air Force Medical Service is itself doing that's maybe particularly focused around wartime types of injuries, such as traumatic brain injury that we're hearing so much about, for example?
We've been collaborating with multiple partners around the country on trauma care for over 10 years. We've worked with University of Maryland at Baltimore Shock Trauma. We work at UC Davis out in California. We work with Miami Valley out in at Wright-Patterson. Pretty much everywhere where I have a hospital, I now have training agreements for my physicians to try and work in their level one trauma facilities so that we're learning every day as things change in American medicine, and also that we're bringing back the innovations from and what we're learning in what is probably the mixing bowl where we see the worst trauma in terms of what's happening in the war. Those relationships have allowed us to basically create some research initiatives. So, for instance, at the University of Cincinnati, where we have one of our training programs for our critical care teams, we basically are looking at how do we automate a ventilator? What parameters do we look at so that you could actually have the computer manage the ventilator? And what we've seen in early studies is that we can get someone off a ventilator 50% faster. And although that sounds really important to you folks who think about just healthcare, for me, the other thing, it saves 30% of the oxygen, which means that I don't have to take as much. And so new planning factors can be developed if we find that this type of equipment can actually do that. Now, don't misunderstand me. I want to get people off ventilators 50% faster too, but I really want the logistics planning so that I can do things even faster and make people well even sooner, okay? And it all comes together that way.
General, improving the resilience and safeguarding the mental health and well-being of service members is critical to sustaining a healthy and fit force. Would you elaborate on your initiatives to optimize mental health access and support among service members? And more particularly, how are you leveraging virtual reality and technology in this area?
We're using several programs to try and do this. We use a lot of telemedicine initiatives to try and link our various mental health shops so that they can talk between one another and share resources. Besides the roughly 80 sites that we now have hooked up through telemedicine so that we can do this, we also are working with the Army and Navy in terms of some outreach for patients who are in remote areas to perhaps give them the ability to link to telemental health. Now, beyond that, we've also got 8 sites where we've set up computer simulations that are we call virtual Iraq that, in essence, also decrease the time that it takes for an experienced provider to get to those issues that are causing someone trouble with post-traumatic stress. So you put someone in front of a computer simulator. You essentially take them back to an Iraqi type of situation where they may be in an urban environment being shot at or have sound that basically may trigger them. But once you see what it is that may be causing them recurrent stress, or if you get to a point where in the simulation they're unable to continue because of something that's haunting them, it allows them then to share that with a therapist and help them to find ways to deal with that in terms of the therapeutic environment. And so all of these things are being brought to fold to try and improve the situation for our warriors. And all of them are being done not just by the Air Force, but linked by all the services and the VA. And we're not yet sure what's going to be the most effective, but we know that we're on the right track because we're being able to reach some of these patients a little quicker, and we're actually able to reach some of them that are not as accessible because of where they live. This is particularly important for the Guard and Reserve.
General, in an all-volunteer service, Air Force personnel choose to join and serve while their families choose to stay. As this is the year of the Air Force family, would you elaborate on what you're doing to mark the importance of this year?
Well, clearly some of the efforts I've described in the patient-centered medical home are geared towards giving them the continuity and the focus that we think they deserve. Beyond that, we're doing a lot in terms of case management and disease management to try and deal with those things that are everyday diseases, but that if we can find new ways to help them stay healthy, it means that their military member who may be worried about someone with a chronic disease gets to worry a little less as they deploy. Obviously, I think that it helps a great deal to know that if a loved one is going over to defend this country and may be injured, to understand that we will do everything, literally everything, okay, to get these folks home safely if they should become injured plays a big role in that. And we work a lot to try and make certain that services are available for families and that there's continuity by working with the A1, our personnel people, in terms of benefits for the families, and also to make certain that if someone has to become a caregiver for one of the injured for a period of time while they're in rehabilitation, that we're also trying to find ways to compensate them for their time and to work with them to make certain that they do have the time to get people that are injured or need rehabilitation all the way back. We're doing a lot with the VA to try and streamline our benefits systems and try and make certain that any of our wounded warriors that have to go through a medical board process, that if when it's time and they go through those processes, that they understand all of their benefits. We've gone to a single physical exam that's shared by DOD and the VA in terms of determining disabilities. And all of these things have shaved a little more than 2 years in terms of the timing it sometimes took to get some of those VA benefits. It's more than the wounded warriors. A lot of the focus has been on how do we take care of families who have special needs children? How do we partner with local school systems to make sure that when we move our patients from one area to another, even here in the U.S., that we don't change the continuity of services and education? We've established and strengthened our Airmen and Family Readiness Centers on the personnel side to make certain that we can answer their questions and that they have caseworkers, that they have the expertise that they need to get the services that may be needed, whether it's for a short time or even if it's for a more extended time. And we're now working to try and create better databases so that we can match up the skill sets that are required by a family when they go from one station to another so that there is no gap in services if we can avoid it.
What does the future hold for the Air Force Medical Service? We will ask Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, An Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts and greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Also joining us today from IBM is Brenda Dixon. General, I talked to many of my guests about the importance of collaboration and partnerships. As we've discussed today, your efforts really rest on partnerships, coordination, and information sharing across the services, the federal government, and even the private sector and research universities. Would you elaborate on the key partnerships you are developing to improve operations and outcomes? And maybe you can share with us and describe some points of pride that illustrate this approach in action.
I think that we take tremendous pride in what we're seeing with our casualty care. And in large part, that comes from our work with multiple partners in terms of training environments at, as I said, University of Maryland and the Baltimore Shock Trauma Hospital, at the St. Louis University, where we have another training environment out near our Scott Air Force Base, up at UC Davis in terms of the programs we've worked with their emergency department and level one trauma centers. Same thing at Wright-Patterson with the Miami Valley Hospital System and out in University of Cincinnati, where we have multiple training sites. Beyond the trauma, okay, we are now exploring different types of relationships with folks who are leaders in information technology. And so we've been working with Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We've also been exploring different types of activities with the Duke Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy, with IBM, with Coriell, Personalized Medicine Collaborative, with the American Cancer Challenge. These types of partnerships and all of these different organizations are at different places in terms of where they are with their research or how they're approaching a common problem. And as we partner with them, we find that we can indeed integrate different efforts to try and achieve a greater whole. And so I would tell you that the promise of the future in terms of what informatics is going to bring to medicine is kind of unfathomed right now. We've been seeing in wounded warrior care what we can do with simple linkages and doing things that our Federal Express has been doing for years before us. If we can get to secure patient messaging and do things for patients similar to the banking industry does and give them a personal health record, the sky kind of becomes the limit. Wherever the patient is, they now have the information. The idea of going to a doctor and having to repeat your medical history five different times for five different people in five different departments is over. And because it's now available to you and you decide as the owner of your patient medical information what you want to share with this doctor or that consultant or this lab. And so I think that these types of partnerships all lead us in a common direction, and that is to fulfill the promise of informatics to medicine.
That is really an exciting vision. What do you see happening in the short term, in the next 3 to 5 years? What's going to make an impact there? What kind of trends do you see?
The patient-centered medical home is going to be a great inroad to try and focus preventive health efforts. I'm not certain with the country's efforts towards health reform whether the new insurance will drive us there in the time frame that you're outlining, but over the next 10 years, I think you'll see a transition. If you think about the late 90s, when we add a lot more people to the insurance rolls, what's going to happen initially is that we're going to have too much business in acute care clinics and emergency rooms. Folks are going to realize once again, as we did in the early 90s, that that's not the best care. Because of that, you'll see some type of reform that will affect our primary care areas to try and get people back into some type of enrolled care. That enrolled care is what's really necessary before you can truly get to the prevention that you want to see. Obviously, I'm leaning way forward to try and make a system like mine become a model for the way we can do that. But there are multiple institutions in the country like Kaiser and Geisinger and Mayo that are basically doing wonderful things in terms of enrollment and trying to get prevention and evidence-based care directly to the patient. I'm just trying to do it on a much larger scale in a highly mobile society, and it's quite the challenge in our informatics world.
So thinking then much further into the future, you have an initiative called Air Force Medicine 2045. Tell us what your thoughts are and the major opportunities and challenges that the Air Force Medical Service will encounter between now and then, and how you're trying to get the service to evolve to meet those challenges.
I brought together a group of fairly amazing people in a futures group that we call 2045. We focused on 2045 with the goal of sustaining this country as a superpower, believe it or not, because in history, it's rare and perhaps the world has never seen one country maintain superpower status for more than 100 years. And so we kind of used that as the place to start. I brought in people from universities and from different industries. We brought in some external speakers and essentially tried to get people to look at what are the drivers, what are the things that will change our world between now and 2045 using scenario-based situations. The futures-based agile thinking, as we now call it, was necessary because when you do the typical lean process analysis, you tend to be focused on efficiency, and everything that the 2045 group is looking at is about effectiveness. What will be effective in changing the future? What are the things that the future must evolve in order to get to the outcomes we really desire, which are better health and better care and best value? And so when you think about those things and try to figure that out in our world, we came up with some strategic imperatives. And those strategic imperatives started with patient-centered care, and that's something that we have to get to today. As soon as we can, we need to get to patient-centered care. We then have to tie in the informatics, okay, on that patient-centered care so that we can basically focus on precision applied evidence-based medicine. We have to be agile in our institutions because the thing that gets in the way of change and disruptive innovation is middle management, okay, because they know how to succeed and get ahead, and we're changing that, okay? So the cheese does move, and so we have to teach them how to succeed in the new world. And we have to partner because there's not a single solution. There's no one institution that's going to find the answer. It's really about how do we partner to try and bring this together and shape a future that we all desire.
Well, picking up on the future, General, what are you doing to ensure you have a well-trained technical workforce in order to meet the challenges of today and the opportunities of tomorrow? What are you doing about recruitment and retention?
We have shifted a lot of our recruitment and retention into scholarships. We found that we had less luck bringing in fully qualified people, that as they finished their specialty and needed to pay off loans and those types of things, they were less willing to come into a military situation. And so we've increased our scholarship programs by almost 600, just a little less than doubling them in the Air Force Medical Service. We've diffused those to a different sets of expertise, not just physicians, but also nursing, pharmacy, physical therapy, trying to make certain that we can attract people who are innovative and obviously in need of money for scholarships. But the reality is that if we can bring in good people, we see good things happen. We have a very active training program, both in graduate medical education, education with industry. We put our people out working in fellowships with various institutions across the country. We try and set up research agreements with different institutions, again, trying to let them share our data and to help us find the new evidence. And clearly, I have a machine, if you will, that teaches them how to operate in austere situations, how to critically think your way out of a situation that no one else may have faced before you. And so our goal is to continue to try and foster creative people with agile thinking who are very good at lean process analysis to try and make things ever better. Clearly, some of this costs a lot of money, and I started off by telling you that I oversee a lot of money. But the reality is we want to be efficient and reapply those resources to make things ever better.
General, you've had a wonderful career, and today's conversation was just terrific. I want to ask you if you have any advice for folks who are thinking about a career in either public service or medicine or in the armed services.
I think that it'd be very simple. Just go do it. You'd be amazed at the things you can get involved with. When I started off some 36 years ago, I told you, I know I was seeking a little bit of structure, and the reality is that little bit of structure has allowed me to be involved with just incredible things. The people I've met, the places I've been, the situations I had to find my way out of and have succeeded have been remarkable. It's not the kind of thing that you can do just being a doc, okay? You can seek a little bit by joining different missionary organizations or non-government organizations, private volunteer organizations. But the reality is that when you look at what the government has to offer, we are involved in worldwide situations where no one else can go. And so it's been a marvelous career. It's been something that I can't tell you how proud I am to have served this country now for 36 years, and I do it again in a heartbeat.
General, that's terrific advice, and I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, Brenda and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Oh, thank you very much. I have to tell you, you know, it probably comes across too much as things that I've been involved with when we do these kinds of interviews. So my thanks would go out to so many people who've been involved in setting up expeditionary medicine and AeroVac, and all of the wondrous things I've talked about in terms of genetics and informatics have come from very bright minds that I've been privileged to work with over many years.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. My co-host from IBM has been Brenda Dixon. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What is the information technology strategy for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security? How is DHS modernizing its IT infrastructure and ensuring IT investments align with its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan next week as he explores these and other questions with his very special guest, Richard Spires, Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.